You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Okay, I think we're going to get going now. So great to see so many people here. I'm Nancy Boehm. I'm a principal researcher at Microsoft Research, where we're happy to have TL visiting us for a few weeks, and she'll be back there in the fall. So I get the pleasure of introducing TL. TL is a sociologist. She's an associate professor at the Center for Computer Games Research at the IT University in Copenhagen. So she's an American who works in Denmark and lives in Sweden and is visiting us here. She is the author of a really great book that came out a few years ago called Play Between Worlds, which is based on an ethnography of EverQuest. And she's got a book coming out really soon, this fall, right?
The Bethnitz book, yeah.
Okay, excellent, called Raising the Stakes.
Oh, no, that one's out now, sorry.
Oh, just came out. And yet another one coming out this fall. Called Raising the Stakes, the Professionalization of Computer Gaming with MIT Press. And as I mentioned, this fall she'll be a visiting researcher at Microsoft Research here in Cambridge, so more chances to get to know and interact with her here. So today she's presenting Watch Me Play, Live Streaming Computer Games and the Future of Spectatorship, which is work in progress. And I've been asked to remind you all that we are being webcast and recorded, so remember everything you do will be preserved on the internet for all eternity. And now I'll hand it over to you.
Thanks. Thanks, Nancy. It's great to be here. I've long followed and admired the work being done at Berkman, so it's really kind of a treat to now get to be here and meet all of you and speak to you about this work that is very much in progress. So just a little background for the talk today. I recently finished up this large project on professional computer gaming, often dubbed esports. How many people have heard of esports before? Oh, okay, great. I'll give a little background for those of you who haven't, but basically we're talking about people competing at the very high end of computer gaming for money and often trying to make a professional living out of it. So when I was completing that manuscript, we were starting to see live streaming make its way onto the scene, but it's really in the last year or so that it's taken off. So in my book, I in brief mentioned like Justin TV and Ustream. But it's only recently where live streaming has really boomed. And so this project is basically me for the last few months trying to sort of see what's happening in the live streaming space. So the talk today is a kernel of a future article on the subject. I'm really looking forward to chatting with you because part of what I'm doing is figuring out, you know, there's always lots of things you can say and then there's important things you should say. And so part of this talk is figuring that out. So I want to just lay a bit of groundwork before diving into live streaming because I want to contextualize it both within esports but also give a little bit more of a historical view. So the first thing I want to do is I want to show you a snippet from a really terrific video by a guy named Richard Lee that came out last year. And it's of a fighting game competition called EVO, which is an annual competition held in Las Vegas. It's been running in various forms since about 1995. So I'm just going to show you a minute of this video, but it'll give you some sense, a little glimpse into the esports scene. All right. If you hit me up, I can give you a link. It's on YouTube. You could Google it as well. It's a really nice video, I think. So at this event, this 2011 event, there were 2,400 competitors and fans in the audience on site. But there were over 12 million unique viewers watching and participating through Ustream, a live streaming site. So one of the things, of course, I love about this video is it highlights this issue of spectatorship, affect, fandom, broadcasting. You may have even got a glimpse of commentating in there as well, which is a big part of the esports scene. All themes that are really important to esports, but I also think can be productively pulled into a conversation about live streaming. So I think one of the things that's really nice is this movie helps us remember that spectatorship has always been an important part of computer gaming, going all the way back to the arcades, and maybe many of you remember this experience, in fact. So whether it was watching over your friend's shoulder, turn-taking, handing off a controller, this mix of playing and watching has always been present in gaming. And now a little, you know, insider horse talk for people who are interested in game studies. I actually think in game studies we've made a bit of a misstep by not paying enough attention to spectatorship and watching. In part, there's been a lot of interest in sort of pulling in interactivity, which is always about hands on the controller. But I think we need to get back to a conversation about audience, spectatorship, and their role in play. You even had, I don't know how many of you are familiar with this, early attempts to bring competitive arcade gaming to the television screen. In 1980, you may recognize Jeff Edwards, who was the host of this briefly lived game show. And of course, LAN parties have long been really great dynamic spaces where people are bringing their machines together to play, to watch, to participate. So this is QuakeCon in 99. DreamHack, which is in Sweden where I live, continues to be one of the largest LAN parties ever. This is a shot I took in 2009 when there were about 11,500 participants over the course of a weekend, you know, bringing machines in, sitting together, playing. This last winter when we went back, there were 20,000 participants, and they had partnered with Twitch TV, again, a live streaming site that I'm going to talk about today, that brought them 1.5 million unique viewers tuning in to watch the esports competitions happening in those spaces. Finally, again, this is mostly background for those of you who aren't familiar with esports. You have a lot of esports tournaments that have now been going on for decades, bringing people on site to spectate high-end play. This is a shot I took a number of years ago at the World Cyber Games, which fashions itself the kind of Olympics of esports. And then those feeds are often piped back to both net-based streaming and traditional television broadcast. In South Korea, there are a number of channels that are dedicated to broadcasting computer sports play. So I think within game culture, we can really easily trace spectatorship, audience, how it's been there present from all the way back to the beginning. And I want to just briefly, I'm now just telling kind of quick and dirty histories to kind of bring threads together, but I just want to mention that, you know, there's an important role non-game streaming has played in to where we are now in this history to look at Twitch. For those of you who've been playing around online for a few decades, you may remember early forays into live streaming video via programs like See You, See Me, right, where you would join what are called reflector sites. You chat with strangers, you chat with friends, think pre-chat roulette, right? And, okay, so this is a screenshot I took of, you can tell, this is me and some friends. If you have a sharp eye, you may have noticed that the window behind the See You, See Me image was a mud window. And this multiplicity of moving through network spaces was happening already back then with these forms of live streaming. Of course, a lot of that early cam culture spun off into sites like Justin TV, Ustream, Livestream, that offer people venues to do live broadcasting of all kinds of things. I don't know, do any of you spend any time on these sites? A couple, okay. Well, it's worth just checking them out because they're actually pretty fascinating. There's, you know, all kinds of like quasi talk shows. There's a lot of live streaming going on. There's a lot of puppy cams. There's always like 5 Shibu Inu puppy cams happening. The Occupy movement also has used live streaming in the last few years to kind of bring together broadcasts of different things that were happening on site. And in fact, if you go to occupystreams.org, it might be, you can see some of those still happening. Okay, so this is a quick and dirty history. Live streaming now meets gaming. So gamers have been using venues like Justin TV or Ustream to experiment with broadcasting their play, but it's only really in the last year or so that we've seen this boom in gaming broadcasting. So you have particular Twitch TV that was launched in June 2011, which was a spin-off of Justin TV, sort of run by the same folks. There's another site called Own3D that does a lot of it. They've been around since 2009. You also have cloud gaming services like OnLive. I don't know if any of you use OnLive. OnLive is interesting too because it allows you to broadcast your play and spectate other play in real time. So this trend is sort of hovering out there in a few sites. So I want to focus a bit on Twitch, since that Twitch TV, it's a website, since that's a platform I've really been looking at, and it's the one that's gained a lot of traction in the esports scene, I think transforming it in interesting ways and maybe transforming game culture more broadly. So Twitch.tv. Twitch has right now, they put at about 5 million gamers monthly visiting the site. It's an 18 to 35 demographic, predominantly male. Average viewers watching the site for about an hour per day. They recently cut some deals with CBS Interactive, and those of you who follow esports, there's been CBS Interactive has become very interested in esports the last couple of weeks and is cutting a lot of deals. I ran across an interesting paper by author Ketui and some co-authors, which was actually titled "Watch Me Playing, I'm a Professional." So clearly, this author and I are both on the same same thread here. So just a few facts about Twitch that they found by doing some mining of the site. They identified the peak audience as Thursday through Sunday. You have a lot of weekend tournaments. Highest activity in the U.S. The average stream duration is 96 minutes, but there's some variance. Average number of viewers per channel, and this will make sense a little bit more in a couple slides, is pretty low. Maybe two people are watching a stream all the way up to 23. But there are a handful of streams that pull in massive viewership, and you'll see that in a minute. The top 10% of streams account for nearly 88% of the views. By comparison, YouTube is, last I read in this paper, YouTube is the top 10% of popular videos aggregate 80% of views, so you can sort of get a sense. And then the final little factoid I wanted to give you is StarCraft II, if you're a StarCraft II fan, pulls in about 35% of the audience, and then games trail off from there. Okay, so when you go to the Twitch TV site, you can immediately see which games are pulling in big spectators. And so you see League of Legends and a number up with a little red icon there. 25,000 people at the time I took this screenshot, which was Saturday afternoon, were watching channels broadcasting League of Legends games. And you can kind of see the scale here. I'm going to give you another one. You can also look at any individual channel to see if you want to spectate it. So again, you can see here League of Legends with a really big stream, but then all the way down, you start getting into the thousands. There are pages and pages you can scroll through, and many of them are one spectator, none spectator. So there's a real interesting range there. You can see this perhaps a little bit when you look at channels. This is all of the people, 141 people, broadcasting League of Legends. And again, you can see the numbers of people spectating in real time. So just as a little quick side note, it's not simply major popular game titles you find. I love this one. I was just trolling around the site and found a guy who was broadcasting his Magic Online play. He actually has 300 people watching him play Magic Online. And I love that he's over time had 155,000 views to people watching him, and almost 800 people have favorited him. So this is a pretty classic way that a stream is laid out visually on the site. There's a game broadcast. There's a chat, which is basic IRC channel, some ads, and often some kind of customization banner. And unless you subscribe to somebody's channel, you're going to get ads. So you're going to get hit with an ad usually early on, and you'll get some periodic ads. And those ads are often regionally fed, too. Okay, so I want to kind of run down some of the different kinds of people activities on the site. There's actually an interesting diversity. I mean, I went there mostly looking for the esports folks to start, but there's a lot of people who I would put in a kind of casual amateur category, and they can have pretty detailed web pages, very visually expressive. This is, I'm presuming, a woman named Thumper Jen who's broadcasting her play. Sometimes they're a little bit more sparse. This is just a default background. But one of the things you notice really quickly is the live stream becomes an extension of the sofa space, where the person's not only broadcasting, but also chatting with the people on their stream. You can see this a little bit here. You'll see it in the next one as well. Often they're talking about game problems, querying options about what to do next, remarking on things happening. And I think this is a really interesting aspect of it, because I don't know if you've encountered, when I started looking for literature on this stuff, I ran across all these things that talk about social TV. don't know if you've seen this one yet. I think it's a horrible term. And often social TV means like you've liked a Facebook page of your favorite television show. Okay. This is, I think, a very interesting version of what it means to actually get sort of social interaction in a space, because these are places in where broadcasters are talking to the audience directly. Sometimes that communication is happening via text chat, so the person's actually having to take their hands off whatever gaming device and tap in. Just as often, people are keeping open mics and just talking to people. They can glance at the chat and answer questions verbally through an open mic. They also very regularly do this really interesting, I think of it as a kind of think aloud exercise. Those of you who are familiar with like human interaction research, where you sort of ask people to think aloud what they're doing. So you'll just get this kind of stream of consciousness running commentary on their own play. The other thing you notice, though, is that people are sharing a lot of details beyond their immediate plain broadcast. This ranges from info about who they are, what games they play, the specs of their computers. I found one guy on the bottom half of his page, so the video's at the top and then you scroll down. The bottom half of his page, he had really carefully typed a massive list of all the games he owned. And he said, like, if you want to see me play one of these, just let me know, right? So sort of putting it out here. And I think really what's one of the things that's interesting is this is not just then public performance of one's actual play. It also becomes a public performance of a kind of gamer identity. And I think this is an interesting thing. It's something actually we see in LAN parties all the time, right? Being in public spaces and inhabiting, in a very embodied way, gamer identity. So what we're seeing in live streaming, I think, isn't entirely new to it, but it's allowing people to scale up spaces of play with strangers, sharing their setups, performing this identity beyond the constraints that, you know, having to go to a LAN event or a special event or be physically co-present in their home would sort of situate. All right, so those are the casuals. What first drew me to Twitch was really seeing how it was transforming the professional esports scene. And so one of the things you see is you have top teams using the site as a central broadcast hub for their play. So Alex Garfield, who runs the team Evil Geniuses, who I have a screenshot of here, said at a recent sports analytic conference just down the road at MIT, he said, so I rope in 2 to 3 million unique people a month just on player streams and tournaments. And none of that could be possible if I had to worry about, well, how am I going to get the player? Where's the technology going to come from? Do I have to pay for bandwidth? Like, it needs to be a one-switch activation kind of thing. And some of the live streaming entities have allowed us to do this. So if you're a fan of a team, you can go to these sites, watch your favorite player, not only playing tournaments, but really interestingly, practicing, often for hours at a time. And I think this is fascinating because it means that fan engagement becomes something more than just tournament spectating. While that's still there, and tournaments are a big part of live streaming, it actually gets a little more mundane. You sort of peek into people's practice time. You watch them fail. You can chat with them. You can see their play space. So I don't know if you can see it here. A really typical convention. You see your favorite player, who you may be a fan of, you know, sitting in his bedroom practicing for hours at a time. And in fact, this convention of the pros having a picture-in-picture on their broadcast thing, where the gamer's face, the player's face is in the image, is a long-standing esports visual trope. And this technology is allowing it in really interesting ways. Twitch, combined with video streaming software, combined with low-cost, high-definition cameras, has really leveraged this. And in esports, a lot of esports producers feel that this is a really important part of kind of emotionally hooking into fans, showing who your favorite gamer sort of is in an embodied way. All right, so in addition to teams, though, you also have individual players who are themselves building audiences and fan bases. And this has happened for a long time, so I'm really now thinking about how Twitch leverages and possibly changes it. And one interesting structural and economic repercussion is sites like Twitch have allowed some top players to go independent and no longer be under contract for teams. I don't know how many of you even who follow esports know this, but top esports players sign contracts, much like traditional athletes do, with teams. And those teams can often provide support, but they often place restrictions on where they're playing, revenue opportunities, sponsorship opportunities. Sometimes they take a cut of winnings. So Twitch has allowed some to go independent. And so this is, for example, Grubby, formerly one of the best Warcraft players in the world, now a top StarCraft II player, is no longer on any esports team, and he operates as a kind of free agent. So he and Twitch have an official partnership. He has sponsors. People pay to subscribe to his channel. He has merch. He has, you know, shirts you can buy that are for Grubby. And then he also has his tournament winnings. And you can, I think, see some of this visually represented here about, you know, do you want to show your appreciation? Subscribe to Grubby's channel, basically. So he will interact with people via the chat stream, catching questions that he usually answers via voice, but often typing. So he's, you know, sort of got an eye on the chat windows that's flying by and is engaging. He also has mods that help him monitor his channel and encourage people to ante up. You may note here, a new player, I don't know the percentages, but I know that Grubby wants you to subscribe because it not only gets him money, but it proves to Twitch he's a valuable streamer to be partnered with. So, and the other little thing I want to mention here about Grubby's feed, I don't know if you noticed it, I sort of love it, I think it's terrific. We have his front face view, but he has a second cam on his hands. I don't know if you've ever watched a top RTS player, this is a genre of game, the hand action is actually pretty interesting, so he's sort of really leveraging this, kind of putting you there. And of course, like most media entrepreneurs these days, he crosses platforms, so it's not only about building an audience via Twitch, but pulling people in via Twitter, Facebook, and in fact, if you follow someone on Twitch, you can set it up so you get an email when they start broadcasting. So you have this kind of continual media loop experience of fandom and being pulled into the audience. Another set of independent actors really leveraging this space are broadcasters and commentators who've long played a really central role in esports. So these are people who, when you're watching an esports tournament, will do very much like traditional sports commentating, explaining to you, explaining to the audience what's happening. They also do a lot of talk shows, interviewing top players, giving feedback. You know, again, think traditional sports, right? Ported over. So they're doing a lot of cross-media as well, and they're using live streaming to provide massive, constant content to the fans. Now, interestingly, you don't need to go to Twitch to get that stuff. A lot of those channels get pulled into their own branded spaces, so you can visit. This is Day 9, a really well-known commentator. You can actually just go to his site and watch feeds live as well. So they're also doing stuff that's pulling Twitch into their own spaces. Now, it's interesting because when you talk to the people who've been around in esports for years and years now, they'll tell you about the difficulties early on with trying to do broadcasts with things like Winamp. Maybe some of you even remember these days. And, you know, the real struggles around technology, network bandwidth, trying to pull it all together, and the ways Twitch has really changed a lot of this for them. Not just Twitch, but live streaming in general. Technical difficulties, network limitations, cost, the challenge of pulling an audience into a cohesive site has really been upended with a lot of the live streaming, so that a lot of these people can now start building constant audiences that know where to go to find them. Interestingly, though, I think much like those casual players I mentioned in the beginning, these guys are also interweaving audience with community in important ways. And community is a big thing in esports. It's the scene thinks of itself in terms of communities. So broadcast and interactions become another site of community work. So Sean Plott, who is Day 9, said at the same Sports Analytic conference recently, it ends up not being an audience, it's a community. So there's a hyper-regular dialogue between what you're doing and what the community is doing, and there's like a super thin wall. And I think we could, of course, here nod to perhaps Nancy's work on musicians and their relationships with audiences, but this interrelation between being a broadcaster but also interfacing with your audience, your community. So, of course, this audience community is the bedrock in which ad revenues and partnerships get built. So it is a monetized community in the end. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. Finally, we're seeing really amazing growth in live streaming with around tournaments. So there's tons of examples of this, but I'll just give you one anecdote. This was several months ago, I think it was. I was just sort of, again, browsing around Twitch, and I saw a lot of people in one stream called Iron Squid, and I had no idea what Iron Squid was. And I went in and found myself in a really big, watching a really big StarCraft II tournament. So this is the on-site view. It was in Paris. There were 2,600 StarCraft II fans. They had lined up around the block waiting to get in. I was sitting in a channel, though, with upwards of 20,000 people with chat, you know, that IRC chat window completely unruly at this point, you know, just streaming by. And that was, I think that was actually the first moment I went like, you know, I've spent the last 9 years going to tournaments on site at various locations, you know, dragging suitcases to remote locales, and now suddenly live streaming is opening up audience and spectatorship in this interesting way. So you have also outfits, and this is a slight departure from Twitch, but I want to mention them. You also have outlets like Major League Gaming, who've been a longtime console league, but they've moved now into StarCraft II as well, who've been pushing live streaming for a while now, offering all kinds of season passes to watch their tournaments, often now in HD, right? So one event reached 175 countries. They had 241,000 people watching at one time, with an average engagement time per viewer of over 3 hours. So people really spending a lot of time on the site. Now, there's debate in the community about whether MLG's model, revenue model of sort of selling these season passes can scale up for all of esports. But for me, it certainly echoes things like you see in Major League Baseball. I don't know if any of you are MLB fans, and if you have the MLB app on your iPad, and you know, you can buy a season pass and get live streaming, you know, archive and live streaming of your favorite games throughout the season. So there's some interesting parallels here. On a, just a little side note, there's a growing scene called Barcraft that involves, and there's a Boston Barcraft, there's one on Sunday if you're interested. It involves taking over a bar for the purposes of spectating esports. The last one I was at in Boston, they had an MLG stream running. We didn't pay to get into that bar, but we were all there spectating an MLG stream. So Barcraft sort of loops this back to spectating in another interesting way. So Axel Bruins, a media scholar, has written that streaming media and downloadable videos can no longer be considered as poor cousins of broadcast. Indeed, it's possible to argue that television, even if enhanced through PVRs and home theater systems, is failing to keep up with the developments of online media. And for esports, this is certainly the case. And the interesting thing in esports is there have been many years of failed attempts to bring competitive computer gaming to a wider audience via television. And live streaming seems, at least for the community, to be offering a new venue to scale up spectatorship, but in ways that resonate with the emphasis on community that esports values, and also resonate, you know, you'll hear sometimes people in esports talk about, you know, why would people who are spending lots of time in front of their machines playing games, why would they suddenly decide to walk away from their machines and sit in front of a television? That somehow the actual physicality of the medium makes more sense when it comes to live streaming. So I think for many in esports, these sites become a kind of welcome respite from this constant line that competitive gaming will only be legitimized when it gets on TV and gets audience that way. They're starting to see numbers that kind of making them feel like a little bit proud. Okay. So a few just, I'm just going to, there's so many here, but there's, I just want to thread a few thornier issues to ponder. And the first I just want to head implicating your friends. So one interesting thing that happens is when you make your play public is you may also be making the play and in some cases the identities of your friends public as well, whether they want it or not. Now, I'm showing you a low-res version of this picture. If you saw the original, what you would see is a guy playing WoW, and in the back panel, his friends list, but he's using real ID, so all of his friends' real names are there. All of his whispers and chats are here in this window. Now, I don't know if all his friends are aware of this. Maybe they are. Maybe they've signed off on it. But it raises interesting questions about when you publicize your play, how you're expanding the space of public to your friends as well. There's actually Emma Witowski, a fellow researcher at the ITU, in her field work on team sports and computer games, encountered this terrific moment where a guy had been live streaming the raid encounters the guild was doing, big, massive events, you know, 25 people. But not everybody knew he was live streaming. So he sort of, you know, he thought it was a great thing to kind of put it out there. And apparently they weren't too disturbed by this, but it just raises, I think, some interesting questions about, you know, what happens when your own public performance perhaps unwittingly enlists others you're playing with. There's also, of course, the issue of botting and artificial viewers, something that sites like YouTube struggle with or deal with as well. There is money at stake here. I mean, we're basically talking about sites that are driven, you know, through ad revenue. People get money based on how many viewers they have, so it's probably not surprising. We see folks trying to find ways to up their viewership numbers artificially. There's also really interesting issues, I think, around, you know, creating and maintaining an audience. And I think one of the things you notice when you spend time on Twitch is actually how much heterogeneity there is in game culture. Sometimes, I mean, I do it myself. I use the term game culture as kind of a quick shorthand. But game culture is actually fairly diverse. There are lots of kinds of different players in game culture, lots of kinds of different games. I was just struck by this as I was watching this guy play a game called Fez, which is kind of a indie favorite. You know, some people really rave about it. And in fact, you see he has 479 people watching. It was a really quiet channel. But you see somebody popped in and said, you know, what the hell kind of game is this? And this is not uncommon. You know, esports communities are constantly debating whether or not a title is really an esport title. But it's just a kind of nice reminder, I think, about the heterogeneity of game culture. Of course, for those trying to make a living through broadcasting, what gets watched and promoted has real financial implications. And I was struck by this when I was watching Grubby's feed one day, and he'd been practicing for hours, and he'd gotten an invite to come play this really crazy version of soccer, but in the StarCraft II universe. you know, a kind of goofy game to play as a little break. But you can see, actually, in the chat, there was some concern by one of the members, one of the people I think who's a subscriber to his feed, about the loss of audience. So you see, Wallop says, one game of soccer is 1,000 less viewers, and the other half being sad there isn't any 1v1, so it's not worth it, right? So there's this interesting issue, I think, that happens about maintaining an audience and this balancing act. You have this juxtaposition of professional players who are making public the very mundane nature of being expert, which is hours and hours of play, failing, breaks, downtime, bathroom runs, all that gets put out there. And I think they're having to balance it against actually being a celebrity and having fans and having this kind of constant audience that they're wanting to keep up. Okay, the final issue I want to mention, and it's actually, I have to admit, it's the one I'm sort of constantly drawn to and fascinated by, and it's the issue of regulating broadcast and intellectual property issues in computer games. So we could talk then about the actual content of the broadcast themselves as being up for discussion. So you have the game itself that's being broadcasted, you have that chat window, you have audio, very often not just game audio, but they're playing their favorite, you know, playlist from iTunes that's now going out publicly being broadcast. So there's a lot of questions that some users have about what they're allowed to broadcast. And when I was first curious about how Twitch was handling this, I sort of looked, you know, like, okay, well, where are the rules? And it took a little digging around. I had to go into the forums and then read multiple, you know. So these are just screenshots of a number of the different threads covering, you know, what you're allowed to broadcast. And there's all kinds of things. There's talk about whether or not you can broadcast emulators, whether or not you can broadcast nudity. There was this hilarious thing on the can you broadcast nudity bit, where basically the answer was, you know, M-rated games, no problem. So somebody said, what about Second Life? Would it be available for casting? Would it be considered a porn game? And the administrator for the site said, for Second Life, I'm going to say no. Second Life is not itself a porn game, but a vast majority of the game's user-created items are porn-related to an unavoidable degree. There really isn't any safe spot you could stream in that game without the risk of accidentally showing something we would not approve of. So the range of games you're allowed, Second Life was only saying, oh no, it's too risky. There's, you know, porn at every turn or something. So, okay, so there's lots of kind of feedback and guidance on what you can stream. And of course, individual channels also themselves have rules about how they handle chat. They may have chat rules, they'll ban people for them. There's also some technological regulation, because a person who has a channel can set up a profanity filter and turn it on, so that's going to automatically regulate the content. Okay, so I found all these threads, and I don't know if you can quite tell, but they were all answered by Horror. All. Horror was really on top of this. So you can look at Horror's profile. All right, so what I know about Horror is tagged as an administrator. Horror's about is referring to Twitch TV. So I'm assuming they're employee, but I don't know 100%. All right, so, but they were on every question, except the elephant in the room, which is, do I need to ask the game company permission to broadcast this game? So here is the one question about this issue, the actual broadcast of the game. And I thought this was fascinating. horror did not appear to answer this one. It was answered by two other moderators who I think are probably user moderators, but I'm not entirely sure. And you can see them working through whether or not you're really allowed to broadcast game content, right? So Havoc says, I would think, so the question is, do I need to get special permission to broadcast my games? And Havoc says, I would think not if the game's already been released, you know, probably falls under, you know, fair use guidelines. You can see the next person fires a little more definitive. You don't need permission. Twitch doesn't seem to require a license. So then we sort of shift to a little bit of a more, doesn't seem to be, okay. So this is actually not just a Twitch issue, and I really want to foreground that, because there is a big hornet's nest in esports around intellectual property regulation and game broadcast. And right now, live streaming is this kind of interesting, almost Wild West frontier. So Kara LaForge, who's Day 9's manager, said at a recent, she, Day 9, and a couple other people visited a class at MIT to talk about esports. And one of the things she said about this issue of intellectual property in games, she said, it's scary. It's very scary stuff. We're so ambitious. We keep wanting to bring in these elements of traditional sports. We can't even find the people to write the tools to do what we need to do and to get the permissions. You know, we're asking people to build tools on top of other people's IP. You're talking massive negotiations to pull this off. So people, including professionals, teams, are setting up partnerships, building models for revenue, making money, broadcasting game content. And this is content that has historically been governed by pretty active ownership claims on the part of game companies. Right now, companies seem to be giving it a free pass, seeing it as good publicity. 20,000 people on the Twitch site, spectating League of Legends, go, right? And in fact, some game companies are even working with leagues, working with Twitch to build this stuff. But I think we have hints of how this may not scale up so easily. One of the stories I recount in my esports book is of the 2010 skirmish between KESPO, which is the Korean Esports Association, and Blizzard, who ran into some serious head-to-head over licensing and IP issues. Their talks broke down at the time, and Blizzard went with another provider, a broadcaster. They've just now come back to the table and managed to carve out a new agreement. But that incident, to me, highlights that we should probably be a little cautious that this issue is probably not a done deal, because there are big things at stake in the broadcast and licensing of games, I think especially as revenue grows. One of the core issues facing esports and games writ large is, I think, what happens when our new playing fields, albeit digital ones, are produced by companies who have an interest in making ownership claims. And when those companies sometimes assert a right to roll up the playing field in the middle of the game. So right now, live streaming and the actual numbers of people making a profit off it seems to be small enough that this issue of licensing hasn't kicked in. In fact, if you run a tournament over a certain side with a certain prize pool, you'll enter into a licensing agreement. If you're broadcasting, as they do often in South Korea, you'll enter into a licensing agreement. We just haven't seen it yet hit the scale of Twitch. But I think as channels start getting 1,000, 10,000, 20,000 spectators on a regular basis, perhaps we could then start having to really talk about audience and the monetization of that audience. It's going to be interesting to see if that hands-off model holds. And I think one of the things that's happening is some broadcasters are banking on building something so strong with their brand and with their audience that companies wouldn't dare mess with it. And so I'll just close by giving you a quote from Day 9 Sean Plott that he said at one of these recent public events. He said, so I mean, if let's say in 5 years there's like 15 million people watching the Day 9 Daily every night, this is his show, let's just say that's the circumstance. And then Blizzard realizes this and says, well, hey, we don't want to do it. We want to do a daily talk show with on StarCraft II. We don't want some nerd doing it. And they tried to cut me out. Then all of a sudden, there's going to be these 15 million people saying, you took our entertainment away. All right, thanks. We have a lot of time for talk and questions or whatever. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Oh.
No, thank you. So basically all the games you mentioned are PC games. And I was wondering, if you see any evolution of these kinds of things that are happening in the PC live stream sphere coming into the next generation of console systems.
Yeah.
And how those companies will attempt to control that kind of system.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so the regulation of consoles is a fascinating hornet's nest of its own, right? Everything from the way hardware encodes and regulates all the way up through sort of software regulation. People do stream console stuff. It's a little more cumbersome. You've kind of got to have other technology intervening. This idea of the social seems to be one game companies, broadcasters, everybody's kind of leveraging, and this idea of sharing play. I don't know how much they're going to build this stuff in. E3 is happening right now, so maybe somebody's already heard of some announcement of E3 where they're going to be doing this stuff. But yeah, consoles are an interesting space. They're also an interesting space because they're hooked up to your television, right? So I don't have any concrete data. But certainly on Twitch, you can find people streaming console stuff. It just takes a little bit more hacking together. I don't know if that... Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Sure.
On that last slide, I noticed, I was close enough to see it, that there was discussion about whether it was okay to be streaming unreleased and beta games. And I'm curious, can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, so there's a thread, and they talk about if you're under NDA, you probably shouldn't do it. And a lot of the language is like, you probably shouldn't. You might not want to make anybody angry. It's a rule, but it's a kind of soft rule in some ways. But yeah, there's a whole kind of thing about, be a little careful around these things, don't break NDA. So they clearly want to respect some bounds in relationship with the game company. Yeah, Steve.
What attempts have companies like Blizzard tried to or kind of what initiatives are they taking to try to bank on this? It seems like they should be moving in right now.
Yeah.
Or they're going to lose control of it. Why aren't they working with these live streamers or trying to make their own networks?
Yeah. Blizzard's an interesting company. They've been really supportive of esports in a lot of ways. Like, they actually had community managers dedicated to the esports scene, and they do a lot to foster tournaments. They do a lot to support tournaments. I recounted in the book, I had an opportunity twice to talk with, at the time, the community manager for the esports division. And it was a really interesting balancing act because, they were really clear that they're a game company, and he would sort of keep saying over and over, like, we don't want to be FIFA. He said this multiple times, right? We don't want to be FIFA. But at the same time, he also sort of expressed concern that players were getting treated well. They want their game to be represented in a particular way in public. So it's this very interesting balancing act. I don't know if they just don't. I mean, I don't know what they're thinking, if they don't know how to leverage it, if they don't want to get into it. Right now, they seem to be going the model of partnerships. And that's what they've done for a long time with esports, is let's just find good people to partner with. But if it really scales, I don't know if that keeps being a sustainable model. Pass the mic, yeah.
Thanks, Teal. That was a really super interesting talk.
Thanks.
When you were talking about the chat stream as the extension of the couch. Mm. I was thinking about the recent discussion about live tweeting television shows,
yeah,
and how it's kind of created a sense of people wanting to live participate in, like, when the show is actually airing, sit
right
down and discuss it. And so I was thinking about, have you thought at all about the audience practices around these types of games and sports, traditional sports audiences, mm-hmm, and also more television fandom audiences and the way that they participate in these kind of live events?
Yeah. So when I was trying to sort of see what literature was out there, as I mentioned, I stumbled into this social TV thing. And, yeah, the most reductionist version of that is clicking like. The other version is being involved in Twitter streams about your shows. I don't have enough sense of those to know if there's a lot of dialogue going on or if it's just a lot of monologue. My experience sometimes with Twitter is it's a lot of monologue, so I'd be curious to know if there's dialogue going on. In terms of traditional sports fandom, I am actually continually struck by how often there's just a very close one-to-one mapping. In part, it's intentional. I mean, part of what esports really does is leverage how sports work in everyday culture. So those conversation points, for me in this regard too, Barcraft is a fascinating loop back, right? So I'm really interested to see what happens in that scene. What's your sense of the Twitter? Do you have a sense of the Twitter? Is it a conversation mode when it comes to television?
Yeah, I think it's a conversation. It's about, like, a lot of the time I will see people saying, like, wow, oh my god, hashtag Mad Men or hashtag Revenge.
Right.
It's about, experiencing that in a collective, I think you I mean, I love TV shows, Nancy does too, and it's sort of, if you're not sitting there watching the show at the time that the television show is actually airing, you're missing out on it, which is sort of totally different how I've experienced television fandom online in the past, whereas you watch a DVD of something or you watch something 3 weeks after it broadcasts and you go on a forum or you go on Usenet or something and you discuss it. This is much more of like an alive, immediate co-watching.
Yeah. I guess here then there become really interesting questions about the impact back on the, of the conversation on the broadcaster. Yeah. And there's a really clear correlation of this in the tweets, in the Twitch streams. You can see that constant feedback. I mean, of course, contemporary television broadcasters are also engaged with that stuff. You know, I remember watching the commentary, Ronald Moore commentaries to Battlestar Galactica that he would do, and like his wife had always been reading the forums, and you know, it was clear they were in some kind of conversation with the fan community. But
This is not the question you think is coming.
Okay.
I was really struck by the, what's the guy's name? The one you focused on? The
Grubby?
Grubby.
Yeah.
That Grubby describes himself as an athlete.
Yeah.
And so I see the sports metaphor in terms of spectatorship, but I'm wondering, what is your take on athlete as a term to describe these players?
Yeah. athleticism is one of those really thorny issues in esports. I feel like I'm unduly plugging the book, but in the book I make a case that we have to pay more attention to the embodied aspects of computer gameplay. And when you talk to pro players, especially if they're competing on a high-end circuit, I mean, they'll talk to you about fatigue, exhaustion. You'll watch the hand movements they're doing, and most of us can't do them. So athleticism is funny, too, because often when we talk about it or when we talk about sports, we pull up the kind of mythic, you know, the soccer player, the basketball player. There's actually a whole range of athleticism that invokes technology, that invokes small, precise movements. So I don't know. I tend to be sort of persuaded by that language.
I guess I'm next. I'm interested if you've done any, like, looking at, like, the YouTube streaming play phenomenon that's not live and how that is sort of different. I understand they don't really react to an audience in the same sense, but, like, whether there are different ways that people think about their play when they're, like, videoing it to be viewed.
Yeah, it's a really important point, and especially in esports, because actually, I don't know if any of you are familiar with Henry Lowood's work on Machinima. He does fantastic work on Machinima. He actually makes an argument that the earliest moments of Machinima were actually competitive gamers recording their play and putting it as static, you know, video on demand, VODs for other people to use. And recording your play has a really long tradition in esports, both for being able to spectate after the fact, but also as training, as watching videos of the competitor you're coming up to in a month so you can prep. It's something I haven't, and if people have tips on good literature that would help me into that space, I'd be really grateful, because I think, this does not appear out of nowhere, right? It actually comes from a long tradition of using video in interesting ways, so it's, thanks. It'll work its way over there, I guess.
It seemed like a lot of the live streaming, it was very kind of static in the sense that you saw what the person who's playing the game sees.
Yeah.
I know that a lot of these clients, they have, like, it's all in logs, and you can go back and watch it, and you can go from any perspective, anything else. And I'm wondering if there's any of that worked into the field.
Absolutely. So this is where I'm a little bit kind of flattening things a bit for the purposes of this talk. If you follow a channel that's broadcasting a tournament, very often tournaments, some are quite heavily produced, others less so, where you will have multiple camera perspectives. They're jumping across people's different PCs. They may even have, very often, they have a commentator PC that's following the action a certain way. So you really have this range from, you know, I mean, I'm doing it now to just kind of figure out how the site works. You know, I have my Diablo 3 feed up, and it's just that, all the way up to very heavily produced. And that's something that's been around in esports for a while now. Of course, one of the things you often hear people talk about in the scene is just about, you know, how much easier it has gotten to sort of do these kind of massive production stuff. And also, as game companies tune into the fact that, oh, maybe we should put a spectator mode in our game. You know, not all games do that. And that actually changes then the possibilities for audience. So.
Well, I was wondering if there was any, like, the audience itself ever was given control in the stream.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay.
You can see it from the perspective that you...
Yeah, so the thing you mentioned about log files, you know, in some games it's possible to basically download the data of that session and replay it, rewatch it. And that becomes a way in which you can sort of inhabit your own producer seat, right? I actually think that's happening. I want to say that's happening a bit less now. These sites have actually made it so much easier to pull people to one place where there's a stream happening. I remember when I first started doing esports, yeah, sometimes you had to go through these really crazy backflips to try to figure out where's that file and how do I get it, and now I've got to open up, you know, Counter-Strike. And so, yeah, I think it's changing a little bit, actually. So I think here, and then, so we make sure we get you. Yeah, sorry.
So I'm wondering if you've seen a modification in fanish behavior with the streamings, but you have so much more content that you could then riff off of in fanvids.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting lead to look at. So fans certainly, can you say respectate? Fans certainly talk together about matches and rehash moments textually. Maybe they do screenshots. Of course, people who do more professional commentating could relook things. It would be interesting to see, actually, if this changes in some way. Yeah, that's. I don't know. I haven't thought of. Yeah, it's a good tip.
Right behind you.
I was wondering if you'd looked at any sort of parallels between the growth of the professional poker taking over ESPN, sort of another thing that's not traditionally considered a sport, or athletes, and how that compares to online.
Absolutely. Games. So in the esports community, amongst people who are trying to bring esports to the masses, poker is a huge story. It's a huge waypoint because it brings something that hadn't been on TV before. It gets massive audiences, and people often remark about, you know, the really crucial invention of the lipstick or the pocket camera, allowing you to see people's hands at the poker table, right? So a lot of the people, when I did my field work for the book, a lot of the professional outfits who are developing to bring things to broadcast television really use poker as this huge waypoint. And there's also this funny corollary, which is there's a number of top esports players who are also top poker players. And sometimes esports players retire to become top poker players. So there's some kind of interesting link there. But yeah, it's a really important, you know, any of those activities that are often thought of as either lifestyle sports, so volleyball is another one that can sometimes get invoked, lifestyle sports, or, you know, BMXing. UFC is another one that the scene talks about a lot. All of these become kind of like, well, if they could do it, maybe we can sort of leverage ourselves. Yeah, chess is an interesting one, actually. So one of my first fieldwork moments was going to a tournament, and I was interviewing the guys. And so you meant it as a joke, but now I'm going to give you a story. I was interviewing one of the guys who's an old RTS player, real-time strategy player, kind of quiet, mild-mannered guy. Really top player, and he said, so I was like, you know, tell me about the scene. He's like, well, you know, we're the RTS, but we're like the chess players of the scene. And then he pointed to a Counter-Strike team, which is a five-person, first-person shooter, and he started to say, like, those guys are like the football players. We're the chess players. So, yeah, these things get evoked in interesting ways. All right, so let me take this gentleman, because he's been waiting, and then we can cycle back.
So I was thinking about sort of fandom and the parallels with traditional sports, and I'm wondering if there are rivalries like there are in traditional sports, right? I think a key part of being a Red Sox fan is hating the Yankees and so forth, right? So, yeah, are there rivalries? How do they operate?
Yeah, there are. There are rivalries. There are personalities. And I would say there's certainly a contingent of, you know, the people who are really, you know, they have their sights on making esports a kind of mainstream activity, that see playing those up as an important trope in becoming a sport. So, yeah, absolutely you have those. And you have people who are, you know, they're fans of a team. You know, I remember talking to a young guy, he was probably 13 or 14 at the time, and he talked about how his friend had brought him, you know, they went to his house and were watching a match, and he instantly became a fan of that team, and he, you know, he followed all their matches. So, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I'd like to know, has Contract Bridge come in yet?
Yeah, Bridge is an interesting one because Bridge it's funny, I don't know if it's still up there, but there was a period maybe 5 years ago where if you went to the page to see the Olympic Committee's sort of sanctioned sports, bridge was on there. Right, and so bridge is actually, it doesn't get talked about a lot, but I always found it interesting because it's one of those things we often don't think of as a sport, but you know, for some in that community, they want to kind of put it up to that level. So,
and it's played all around the world.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah, yeah. It's a nice reminder of, in some ways, the flexibility of these categories as well. Yeah. Oh yes. Oh, thanks.
Really interesting talk. One thing that really struck me was a slide that you showed that showed the gear, the computer of musicians and when musicians kind of really made me think of musicians and when being a part of a spectator environment.
Yeah.
The gear matters, but it doesn't happen in all sports, so they're not all talking about that.
Yeah.
I was wondering if that was something that you saw in many of these.
Gear is huge in esports, and I actually make an argument that it's more than just kind of a tool, that gear becomes part of the assemblage of play. It becomes part of your embodied practice. So one of the things you'll see immediately if you go to esports tournament is people push aside the keyboard that the tournament organizer has brought, and they pull out their own. And they pull out their own mouse, and they pull out their own mouse pad, and all of these things become really important to how play gets performed. And for me, this is a really crucial issue because it means we can't just look at the software product itself to tell us how play is going to unfold. There's lots of other stuff, including material artifacts, that play a really important role. I cut the slide, but I actually had a slide in here earlier, too, of one of the casual players who, at the bottom of his page, he had a tip jar. Some of them have these chip jars where you can donate, and his was, I need a new CPU. You know, here's how much I need to get it. Would you contribute? So, yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for bringing your work here, TL.
Yeah,
so I had a question about, it seems, or if you could clarify, is TV still seen as the goal or the place to be seen? And is there tension among the audiences, the spectators, the players, and the platforms? I would imagine Twitch wants to keep it imagining this is the place to be. But if esports spectators and players think that they've arrived if their sport lands on television, what's going on there?
I think it goes back and forth. And I think even with any given individual, there's a lot of ambivalence. So there's been so many failed attempts to bring esports to television that I think a lot of people feel burned. There's also people who really do feel like it doesn't make sense as a modality given how gamers are. There's sort of this idea of how gamers are. At this sports analytic conference at MIT, it was really interesting because they had Mike Morheim from Blizzard, Alex Garfield, a team owner, Sundance DiGiovanni, who runs the MLG, and Sean Plott, one of these broadcasters. And they were all talking about live streaming and leveraging communities. And it was really interesting because then Mike Morheim said, well, then it won't be very hard to sort of get those feeds back onto the TV. And there was just, the way I read it is sort of this pause, like, oh, are we still trying for that? So that said, I mean, if you talk to these folks, ESPN actually does a lot with esports. Often it's just on their website, but they will tell you if they were approached by any major broadcaster, they would jump at it. But there's definite ambivalence, I think, about where does this stuff belong? Where, and again, a little bit tied to the community, right? What makes sense for the community? Where should we be? So just real quickly, you know, I could have put a whole other screen up here about the way game culture struggles constantly and is fraught with racism, sexism, homophobia. And one of the tensions in the community is, if we're going to go mainstream, how much do we got to clean up? And does the cleaning up change our authentic nature? Not everyone feels this way, but there's definitely a contingent in there that feels like, you know, some of this stuff is real. And if we bring it to the masses, is that going to sort of change who we are as a community? Not all, but parts. So there's interesting tensions there at work.
So I'm curious to see, or to know how much charity and stuff like that fits into this, whether it's people doing a Mario marathon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or something along that, kinds of stuff. How much does that take up some of this space? Is this a small little segment?
Yeah, I don't have firsthand data on that. Certainly in game culture, there's often these kind of play marathons. And in fact, the article I cited that had all these stats on Twitch, I guess some of their stats got a little bit, they had to deal with the fact that there had been a, like 72-hour marathon where the whole team had been rotating into play, and that kind of skewed their statistics. So yeah, you definitely see some of that. And a lot of those charity play events that used to be a little bit, I guess you'd say, more private or kind of statically updated on a web page now get live streamed. So, yeah. Any other?
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Thanks.